everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And I'm very happy to bring on my guest, Leanne Campbell, PhD, who has recently been appointed president of the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies, a not-for-profit organization committed to increasing awareness of the extraordinary impact that food has on the health of our bodies, our communities, and our planet. Leanne has over 30 years of experience working with communities, universities, and schools in the Dominican Republic and the United States. On the international front, she founded and directed a family literacy program and served as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Dominican Republic. She directed an international nonprofit known as the Global Leadership Institute. In addition to serving on the faculty at Mississippi State University and Nazareth College, she worked for several years as an instructional coach, curriculum specialist for the North Carolina Public Schools. She has worked for Duke University's Latin American and Caribbean Studies as a community outreach director. Additionally, she's the author of the China Study Cookbook and the editor of the China Study All-Star Collection and the China Study Quick and Easy Cookbook. She has 2 degrees from Cornell University, a BS degree in Human Service Studies, and an MS degree in Administration of Human Service Programs. She also has a PhD from UNC Chapel Hill in Culture, Curriculum, and Change. Welcome to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me, Leanne.
Thank you for having me.
I've been wanting to talk to you for a very long time. You've been doing amazing work, but I recently got an email from the nutritionstudies.org organization that you have become president. So I was excited to hear that, and I just want to talk to you and find out what that's all about and what your vision is.
Thank you. I came on actually around 4 months ago. We have a program here in the Dominican Republic. It's a program that I've been doing with schools and teachers, and it's been sort of focused on issues of food sovereignty and land use. And we had to cancel all of our programs because of the COVID epidemic, and I ended up in the States for unlimited amount of time. I wasn't quite sure how long I was going to be there, and so I took the position with the center, and it's actually not a full-time position. It's around 25 hours a week, but I'm super excited about the possibilities of working with the center. There's a new certificate coming out that's focused on sustainability and the food systems, and that's work that's very dear and close to my heart. My training, my background is actually more in service and working within a nonprofit area, but they could focus more on community projects, creating community projects. So one of the first things that we're planning on doing is setting up a new service department, and where we are going to be giving out micro grants, you know, $500 to $5,000. And we're focusing basically on 3 areas. Community education and food literacy, and access to affordable and healthy food. And then the third one is sustainability and food equity. So we are giving the funds to organizations who are working in one of those 3 areas. And it's going to be exciting because it's not just giving the funds, but it's at the same time, we're trying to create opportunities to provide resources, provide opportunities for them to network among each other. I know in the nonprofit world, working in my own nonprofit, sometimes it can be a little bit isolating, and it's good to have opportunities to connect with other like-minded people that are perhaps doing something similar, where you can share ideas and learn from each other and resources and that support that you can get.
Would these grants be offered all around the world?
Absolutely.
I know that micro grants, $500, $1,000, can go a really long way outside of the United States.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that's really important. I was just talking with Tim Wise last week, who is the author of Eating Tomorrow. He was talking about AGRA, is the acronym, the African Green Revolution Alliance. And we were talking about how it's not working. And it's basically funded by big foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and there's like no accountability. What was interesting to learn is that some of these big foundations that have tons of money will give the money to other big organizations that have big projects. And then it's just too big and not efficient and not working. And it's the little nonprofits that need so much help, but it's really hard to find them and to help them. They're doing the groundwork, the grassroots work that really makes a difference.
Well, you know, Karen, let me just give you an example. I totally agree. In fact, we just sort of gave out 6 initial grants to sort of like pilot it. And the groups that we gave the money to, I would say that they're doing some phenomenal work. And any way that we can support them and share their stories and inspire them to continue on in any way. For instance, we just gave money to a group in New York City called Aya's Table. And it's a really neat organization. He's actually working with hospitals and, you know, trying to provide culinary rehabilitation for those patients who have had like a, you know, heart surgery, and now they need to learn how to eat right. And so, you know, it's a rehab program that he's basically set up, and he goes into people's home and he's teaching them, it's personalized, and teaching them how to prepare really healthy, nutritious, tasty food. And he has 6 chefs now working with them. And he also does it in a group setting, you know, and he's trying to get the Medicaid to cover it as well, the insurance. Oh, yeah. And so he's going to do it in a group setting with those patients where their health insurance, like Medicaid, for instance, that can cover it and provide that same rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a lifestyle change, and we need more support. You can't just sort of send people home and then expect them to, like, voila, make these changes. You know, it is a type of rehabilitation. I love the way he's phrasing it.
Culinary rehabilitation. That is genius.
It is.
It says it all right in 2 words. Words that I think would have more meaning in our medical system.
Absolutely. And so we would like to invite him to come on to our platform as well to engage in a webinar to discuss, you know, how can we help get medical insurance? What can we do, you know, as a larger community to push to get medical insurance to cover this? And so working with him, and then another group is Transplanting Traditions in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And she started it as a small community farm. It's now a collective farm of over 8 acres. It's actually also centered on the Burmese refugees, which sort of morphed. It became a process, but you know, it's employment. It's also creating a food hub. They now provide food to over 320 families. You know, it's amazing what you can grow. Well, I know from personal experience what you can just grow on 2 acres of land, and the amount of food that you can generate, and healthy food. And also, you know, the employment that you can create too, and creating like these local food hubs, supporting her and getting her work up and going and trying to create more sort of like winter, you know, hoop houses where she can continue to produce food. And then we're also we also provided funds for a teacher in an elementary school. You know, she's doing a community garden. She's doing culinary classes. It's all food literacy, based on a plant-based diet. We have 3 other groups that we also funded, but they're all they're very broad, and they're looking at it from different angles. And I think it's really, like you said, I think the money is going to go a long ways.
I'm very excited to hear about this, and I could listen to all of these stories all day because they're inspiring. How often do we get to hear the inspiring stories in this dark and gloom and doom culture that we're in right now?
Absolutely. And you know what's interesting, Karen, is that food creates community. And I think right now in this time, as you say, a food movement can have the potential to create community, can to engage each other, looking at critical ways of how we can support each other and creating a communities of health. That's one of the goals.
Yeah, I'm very excited to hear about it. The organization is already doing lots of wonderful things. My favorite thing on the website, it's just my thing, is the article that T. Colin Campbell and Thomas Campbell wrote, the critique about Dr. Stephen Gundry's Plant Paradox book. That's the article that I send out over and over again. That's in my circle. I'm always hearing about, what about lectins? What about lectins? That article is the one that I go to. But there are just so many great resources on the website already. And it's a place that I know I can trust.
Well, you know, we're trying to actually add maybe 3 new sort of series on that, talking about that. One is with the book Whole, which I don't know if you've ever read the book
Whole. Of course, yes.
Yeah.
And talk to Dad about it, yeah.
Yeah, and trying to create a series, a weekly series on it, sort of calling it Whole Food for Thought, taking a quote from it and then adding discussion questions to create more of a forum around some of those questions, because, you know, I think that encompasses so many issues that we're looking at, sort of the politics behind this and trying to make those explicit and to sort of see where we can, you know, put our energies into trying to address some of these issues.
The book Whole and the concept Whole Food Plant-Based. Did Dr. T. Colin Campbell come up with that phrase? Because a lot of people have grabbed onto it and kind of morphed it. It's not necessarily exactly what he meant all the time.
Right, exactly. He came up with it when he was near the tail end of his study that he was doing in China. And with that study, I think that's when he first phrased that word, whole food plant-based.
It's a powerful statement. And it's important when we have acronyms or little catchphrases that say a lot in a little, because we're such a soundbite culture. Absolutely. But whole food plant-based really is powerful. And it's something that we obviously need to get back to, because when it comes to the food system, we are lost. Absolutely. And it's so detrimental to health and environment and animals. So what's it like in the Dominican Republic and the work that you've done there and what's going on with COVID? You look great. You've got a lot of great color. Looks like the sun's been good to you.
It has. We were just at the beach actually this past weekend. Yeah, so I've been here off and on for the last few years with this program that we have here, the education program, and we do different events with schools, high schools, teachers, and some, you know, colleges. But we have a project here, creating food forests and dry riverbeds. Mm-hmm. And in particular, we're trying to work with land that was once forested, and it has been completely deforested for the livestock, for pastures, creating pastures for cattle. And for me, I was here almost 30 years ago in the same province. And the changes that have happened over the 30 years, you know, coming back almost 30 years later, I wasn't really here in between. But coming back and seeing those changes that have occurred during that time, it's actually, for me, it's terrifying, because the changes have been so drastic in terms of the amount of trees that have been cut down. And all of this, almost I would say 90%, is to create pasture land for cattle. And that land that has been cleared, thousands and thousands of acres, you know, that right here in this area going all the way up the mountain, the rivers have dried up. A lot of the riverbeds have dried up. I would say close to almost, people here tell me like 80% of the water that used to flow in this area that's no longer available. Not only that, but, you know, taking all these trees down, the diversity too, has also diminished incredibly in terms of the different native fruit trees. A lot of those are gone. So I have some land here where we have the education center. And when I first bought it, it was very barren. So we've created a food forest here. I now grow over like 90 different food items. And I have 2 acres of land, and I produce almost 40,000 pounds of food over a 2-year period. And then right next door to me, that used to be, you know, the small community farms, now with one cattle, you basically need almost the same amount of land for 2.5 acres after a 2-year period. That's, you know, almost 400 pounds of animal flesh, right? If the land is healthy and producing enough grass. And so 400 pounds compared to 40,000 pounds, all organic, wide diversity of food. I'm pretty much 100% living off the land right now. And I have food to spare to give to the neighbors, you know, and it's basically a sort of a food forest too, that we're growing. We have you know, all the root crops, the mid-level, and then the higher trees, the avocados and the zapotes and so on. But we have, like, below that, we have the bananas and the plantains. We also have cacao, chocolate, and lots of other fruit trees. Yeah, and then a lot of the root crops, you know, the yautía, the cassave, and yuca, and sweet potatoes galore.
That's fabulous. The foods we're supposed to be eating, the diverse array of foods we're supposed to be eating.
Yeah, and you talk about sustainability, Karen. This is not sustainable, what's going on beside me. And we need how many planets to keep that going? And not only that, 7 years ago when that land was cleared, every single year since then, there's been less and less and less cattle on that land because the land is becoming dry. It's becoming barren without that organic matter coming down from the trees. And you take that over there compared to what we have here, planting more and more, mulching the land and bringing the soil back to life.
Do you have an opportunity to talk with your neighbor?
Do you
share what's going on?
All the time. I go there every other night and play dominoes with all of my neighbors. So
do they think you're crazy or are they curious?
No, not at all. In fact, so we have one of the things that we had when we started this, you know, I wanted to try to grow some of the criollo, the native trees. If you go to a tree nursery, there's some hybrid trees that are pretty expensive. I planted a couple of those. And after 5 years, I was just told that, you know, they're going to dwindle and start dying because there are these little dwarf trees. The native fruit trees were not in the tree nursery. So at least the 10 that I lived near that are around me. So we've created tree nurseries. We share all of our trees with our neighbors. So they're planting too. And everyone sort of sees and, oh, can you give us some of these seeds so we can grow them in our yard? And so, yeah, it goes back and forth and people come here all the time. And
that goes back to what I was talking to before about this grassroots effort and the community that's so important, because we have big ag and big corporations that are really trying to take over our seed, force farmers in different countries to use commercialized seeds, hybridized seeds that only work and maybe work with synthetic fertilizers, petrochemical fertilizers, with a method of growing that may show some benefit in the first few years, but now we know over the long haul that it's devastating to the soil, devastating to yields, devastating to incomes.
Absolutely, 100%. And not only that, I mean, I the soil on some of the, you know, the land that where they are using it. So a lot of the farmers here around me use that, but the soil after several years, it's gritty, it's sandy. And it loses all life. It's overheated too, and the yields are going down and down. But the pesticides too kill the pollinators, the bees, and you know the butterflies and all of that. That so my friend down the mountain here who used to have just 20 years ago, you know, almost 40 beehives, and he had a really big sort of forest full of these hives and a really robust business. Now he can barely get maybe 6 hives going. You know, I think
so doesn't he realize that something's happening?
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, and what's sad too is that there's really no education going on. Before, when I was here way 30 years ago, there used to be an agronomer or 2 or 3 agronomers in every province that would come up and do workshops with farmers and stuff. Now there's really no agronomers that are coming and like talking about it. People are using these fertilizers because it's less man hours, and so they don't have to pay as much money. And so when income is really low, you know, thinking that this is the right way. And so it's a challenge. What we're seeing here is that, I mean, Monsanto is a really, or we could should call it Bayer. They have a really, really big presence here. And right beside you go down to the whole entire sort of like down to the Capitol and the sort of the congressional building is there and the sort of the White House, and almost like just one block up, there's a big house that's for Bayer. You know, it's like right there beside them, their presence is
big. Does that affect your growing, the fact that there are other people using fertilizers and pesticides? Synthetic materials?
Not as much, because I'm below me is the road, not on my small piece of land here. And then there's another road sort of on the upper part of my land. And then the land beside me that borders the largest stretch is the cattle, is the pasture land for the cattle. And so no one right immediately beside me or even relatively close actually is using a lot of the pesticides. But the biggest problem, according to the farmers here, it's been the deforestation that has really hurt a lot of the everything. And we've been having these really horrible droughts here as well. And a lot of it too, it's, I don't know the exact reason why, but you know, with the deforestation and the sort of that cycle, that rain cycle. So with all the trees coming down, it's also, there's been less and less rain.
There's so much we don't understand about the environment, and there's a whole world going on underneath us in the soil. And yeah. What we're learning about tree root systems and how trees communicate with each other. And they tell each other where the food is and where the water is, that there's a world going on down there that we just ignore, and not only ignore, but we're destroying.
Absolutely. I know. And it's interconnected because a lot of the beef from here goes to the States. And so, you know, almost all the farmers that are working, that have these big cattle ranches, almost all of them live in the States. And so a lot of it doesn't really stay right here in this area. It's very interconnected. But it's at the same time, I know people here would like to do more, you know, and it's just figuring out their ownership of land. They've lost a lot of their ownership of the land. And like I said,
where's that gone to?
So it's basically what happened was that the large landowners that own the pastures now, they have over the 20 years, they bought small family farms. They kept buying them up because there was a time period where the main crop in this area was coffee. Oh. And so there was a coffee blight. That coffee blight happened, and coffee rust, they call it. A lot of families ended up selling their land and moving to the urban areas because they weren't able to produce like they were before. Enjoying that, one person has continued to buy the land here. And you see the farms all the way up the mountains.
Monocropping commodity foods.
That's right.
Yeah, not a good recipe for sustainability.
Nope, not at all. Not at all.
Oh, goodness. We have knowledge, and yet not everyone has it. And I continue to want to believe that there is no devil in all of this. There is no evil in all of this. It's just ignorance and some sort of blinders that people have to not want to see the truth.
And, you know, Karen, I think that's why we have to engage within our communities. There are people out there that's doing innovative work that would like to do work too. My sons are 25 and 26 and all of their friends, and you know, they're fired up, they wanna do something. And so that's sort of like the idea then behind these micro grants. And we're trying to raise additional funds to support this micro grant process as well. Is in 100% of all the money we raise is going directly into these community groups. 100%. The idea then is to you know, worldwide. I mean, we would like to use or have each group serve as a model for others. It's a solution. And what others can do. And, you know, I mean, we talk about like the loss of the soil and within a relatively quick time, if you really work with that soil and, you know, and mulch it and take care of it and providing it, and you can bring it back to at least a state of where you can start producing and taking care of the land, you know. And so when farmed, we talk about the idea of regenerative and resilient. The regenerative, resilient power of food. We know it can heal our bodies, a whole food plant-based diet, right? If it's grown sustainably, it can also help heal our ecosystems. That's transformative in just itself. You know, the power of food and the production of food and to take care of ourselves, our communities, and our ecosystems, you know, that's what we're trying to focus on here with this initiative and trying to spread that message through groups that are doing some pretty amazing things.
So things that we can do, people can support nutritionstudies.org to go to these programs. And then we all encourage everyone out there to get into your neighborhood and get involved and grow stuff, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah,
wherever we can.
Yep. Or, you know, setting up seed banks.
We're
working with a school now who's trying to create within their school a seed bank and working with a retirement home. And, you know, there are seed banks in public libraries, you know, around the country. Now there's maybe around 500 of them, and supporting the seed banks and becoming educated you know, at the same time, I think it's important as we are doing this to continually and constantly educate ourselves around this. In addition to trying to create additional content and material, I would like to almost create like a big forum where we do different kinds of book clubs, you know, and have multiple ones going on at the same time and doing deep dives into some of this information. We can self-educate ourselves and learn about, you know, some of these issues and what we can do.
Your family is the plant-based dynasty, right? You have a tremendous legacy. And what's amazing is you and your brothers, you're all doing something in this area. What was it like growing up? And you all went through a transition, right? You weren't brought up whole food plant-based. Dr. Campbell made the discovery and then thrusted it all on you. What was that like?
I was going away to college when this transition was relatively slow. And when I had gone to college, they were no longer really eating meat, just occasionally as a, you know, almost, I would say almost even as a spice, scalloped potatoes with chopped up one slice of ham in it. But the transition was relatively slow. But then once he found the information, you know, I came back a couple years after being in college and opened the refrigerator and, you know, there was no milk and there was no cheese and, you know, there was no ice cream. And so, you know, what's going on here? And at the same time, I think my own personal experiences that I had right after I graduated from college really had a big impact on me in terms of thinking, you know, what kind of food I was going, the choices I had and the impacts of those choices. I just thought also for a couple additional reasons, in addition to the health reasons that my father was learning, but for humanitarian and sustainability and for environmental and ethical reasons, I chose to basically, I was going to raise my children. And when I had children, I wasn't going to have any more animal products in my house. I raised both of my sons, 25, 26, 100% on this type of diet. Wow. Where did they get their protein from? My oldest son is almost 6'5". Yeah.
I've seen pictures. They're hunks.
They thrive.
Yeah, they look good. They look great. But you were studying nutrition in college, right?
That's right. I did. I studied community nutrition.
Right. Yeah. Oh, community nutrition. Interesting. They weren't really talking about what you were learning at home.
Not at all. Not at all. It was the opposite. I remember taking a maternal and infancy nutrition class. Yeah, it was very different from some of the stuff that my father was uncovering at that time. And it's a hard nut to crack because the power within the academic setting to create knowledge and then it becomes so entrenched and that knowledge becomes this paradigm that, you know, people don't even want to question it. It's hard. And then when you do start questioning it and stepping outside of it, you're seen as a quack.
Yeah. So that's just like that. So the last thing I want to talk about is food. Uh-huh. And you've authored a number of cookbooks. Nobody can see it because this is audio, but I'm telling you I have it. One of your sons did the photos, which is nice. You mentioned some of the foods that you're growing in the Dominican Republic. So I imagine your diet is slightly different, not just because it's whole food plant-based, but because you're in another country and you can't get all the same thing. So how does that influence what you eat?
So actually, I raised my sons pretty much on a rice and bean type diet, and they call that their comfort food. Dominican beans are really, really tasty. I don't know if you've ever had those, but with a big salad on top or, you know, a couple sides in with it. Here in the Dominican Republic, that's what everyone eats every day at noon, pretty much, rice and beans and with a salad. And then I have here in my garden, you know, I have all the different root crops growing. So we have a lot of cassava, yuca, which I boil up and I then put it in the oven and bake it and make little crunchy yuca fries. Mm. And that's really good with guacamole. I have lots of avocados right
Everything's
now.
Everything's good with guacamole.
Oh, you're right. I know. And salsa, different salsas. We have a lot of different potatoes, like I said. So oftentimes that's what breakfast is. It's more, and then the boiled green bananas and boiled plantains. And then I make oatmeal, but I also grow edamame or soy. And so I make my own soy milk here. I have lots of eggplant in the garden as well, tomatoes, peppers, kale. I have three different types of kale going on. I have probably 1,000 different plants of kale all around the garden. And I have my own peanuts. And so I make a lot of kale salads. I have like three different kinds of kale salads. Then we have lots of squashes too. Mm. So different squashes and make different things with those. The one thing that I don't grow, of course, is rice, but I can get that locally. So I can go down. There's different rice fields here that I can go and get some of my rice at.
Are they impacted at all? You were talking about the droughts and rice needs a lot of water.
Yeah, a lot of them actually have shut down. And wow. So some of them have shut down. But there's still some large ones open. There's also my friends further up have grown rice, and it's rice that's sort of grown in a drier climate. They don't have to have the, you know, as much of the water. It's a very...
Okay, so there are different varieties of rice that you can grow and some don't need as much water?
That's correct.
That's smart. I'm curious. I have property in Costa Rica that I bought in 2005 that I had big plans for and I haven't done anything with. It's kind of jungle property. And some of it actually was used for cattle grazing, but that's since been grown over. There are a lot of trees and it's beautiful. And my friends that are there, some of them grow kale and they had a hard time growing kale in the beginning. And then they figured out how to do it. They have raised beds and stuff. Do you have any challenges growing some of the foods that are not native or not normally grown there?
Yeah, I can't really grow broccoli. I can't, and my cabbage has never really done well either. But the kale, it's crazy because, you know, it's so warm here. And initially I thought, this is going to putter out. It's not going to do very well. I don't know, 3 years ago, it took root and it's 3 years later, it's still producing. It's really, really, really tall. And there's all these little runners that have come off of it. And I take the runners and I plant them. But they're like bushes,
kale bushes, right? Exactly. You just pick the leaves. Yeah. That's
right. I have a lot. And then I have a little raised bed, like you said. And there's a lot of chickens from my neighbors that always come into the yard now since we have everything mulched and all the little grubs, they're always trying to take everything off and trying to get down to the grubs, but or the worms, whatever. Mm. And so it's sort of a battle with the keeping the chickens out. But I do have a little fenced in area where we have I seed everything. And so when it's a certain size, then it's fenced in. And then, you know, I germinate it there and then I plant it. Yeah. And I found that it's really critical to keep it well watered in the beginning. We have a rainwater system here. So we collect the rainwater and then we recycle our water a couple times. And so we water it almost every day when it's smaller. And then now it gets a little bit, it's now very healthy. And then it can sort of thrive on its own.
Did you figure all this out on your own over time? Did you read books?
No, actually.
How did you learn this stuff?
Yeah, the kale was just sort of like, you know, always trying to nurture it, take care of it. And so, yeah, it wasn't with a book. It was just
paying attention.
Yeah. And then, I want to say too, I'm very fortunate because I have some wonderful two brothers that work here at the center, at the education center, and they're fantastic. And they basically have been farming forever. They, you know, look at the land and they say, oh, you need to put 20 more plantain trees down below. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. Or 20 more banana trees. And then, you know, they said, also, let's do a lot more sweet potatoes you can grow here. And so knowing the crops and knowing what grows and, you know, the different moon cycles. And so they grow too based on the different moon cycles they plant. Mm. And so they bring in all kinds of plants that I would not be able to find. And they just, you know, troop down to someone's farm and bring them in. And I have a root crop, which is really interesting. It's a yummy crop and it can grow almost the size of your leg. And so it's a really, and it can stay in the ground for a long time, up to 4 years.
Wow. Will there be a farming book coming out?
I don't think so. It's just, this is just a passion. It's nice to be able to grow your own food and it's really nice.
It is nice and something more of us should be doing. It's hard. I'm living in New York City in an apartment and I try and grow whatever I can on our terrace. It's a little crazy. Yeah. I got to grow something. It's just, it's in me, you know?
Right. Karen, we do have to think about, I'm reading this book here, The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times, Michael Brownlee. And he talks about the food hubs and, you know, if something happens to our industrial food system, within just 2 days, there's no local food hubs. Mm-hmm. Where are we going to get our food from? There's no local, And it's terrifying if you think about the control and or the lack of control that we have over our food system and how removed we are from it and how will we survive if something does happen to that.
I've been thinking about that for a long time, and it's especially come to the fore with the coronavirus pandemic. And in the beginning when it first started, and the first thing I thought of was hoard food, and a lot of people did too, but I was hoarding different food than most people were. I was getting like beans in bulk and grains in bulk, right? And I can't think enough of the gratitude for the people that are out there that not only bring us our food, but the ones that are harvesting and thinking about them getting exposed to the virus. There's just so many things that are connected, and we're so dependent on too big a system. Absolutely. It's a domino effect, and one day it's just, we're all going to fall.
Absolutely. So I think it's important to start looking at the local level at what we can do, you know, try to create those food hubs.
Well, I'm excited that you are president of nutritionstudies.org, and I'm excited to see what comes out of it and the good work that you're doing and expanding and helping so many groups that want to do more.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And hopefully we'll get a lot of people applying for funds. I hope we can spread the word and get it out there. And
there is a lot of money out there. The question is to tap into it.
Yeah, and to tap into it and then to share it. One of the things too that we would like to do is create that, like they said, that network and bring people together, those that get the funds, to join in a webinar and talk about some thematic topics and to share their ideas with each other. Yeah, I think there's a lot we can do. And to talk about, you know, what it is that they're doing, because they are our solution. You know, it's focusing on solutions and their challenges, how they're overcoming them, their successes, how they're achieving them. So to bring them on and have our community leaders talk about this as well. And to, you know, perhaps create additional content, educational content from that as well, that we can share out to the communities.
I think my favorite thing I'm taking from this is the group you're supporting with culinary rehabilitation. That's something that's going to roll off my tongue a lot these days. Culinary rehabilitation. That's the answer. Yeah. I love it.
Aya's Table, and the director and founder of that is Varun Ponmudi.
And I'm going to look him up.
Aya's Table. And I know he's just applied for an NIH grant as well.
Excellent.
And he's really working hard on trying to get some kind of, you know, the health insurance or health insurance to cover this.
Well, I know Dean Ornish and other doctors have had some success with getting their lifestyle plans covered by Medicaid. It should be possible.
Yep, I agree. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, Leanne, thank you so much for taking the time. It's great to see you. It's great to talk with you. I love what you're doing.
Thank you for having me on.
I hope to get to the Dominican Republic one day. I can't go anywhere right now because most of us can't travel. But one day.
If you can, you will have a place to stay here.
Oh, thank you. I will look for you because I want to try your kale and everything else that you're growing. Okay. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
That was Leanne Campbell, PhD, who is the new president of the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies. And that was most delightful. Didn't she sound like a lovely person? And now I'm here to wrap it up and talk about some exciting things at Responsible Eating and Living Pandemic Headquarters. Gary DiMattei, welcome.
Karen Hartglass.
Woo, it's always great.
Shana Tova.
Oh, Todah Rabah, Gary.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
I hope it's better than the last one.
We need a new year. We need it.
We need
to start all over again.
And so I'm just going to say it starts today or whenever this new year started.
Yeah, it started a couple days ago.
But the bottom line is people are celebrating.
People are celebrating.
Because it's a new year.
Hey.
It's a new year.
Yes, and we celebrated by dipping apples in date paste.
In date paste. And you know what? It was delicious.
It was.
It was. It was a delicious switch from agave, which we've done in the years past.
To take the place of honey, which we don't eat.
Right, which we don't eat. But yeah, it was really great. And you made a lot of tremendous foods.
I did.
Oh, let's talk about some of those, because I'm telling you, esteemed guests out there in Radioland, this soup that Karen made was so delightful. And I am seldom surprised in the kitchen.
I blew you away, didn't
you?
You
did.
Yeah.
You did. And it's an un-chicken soup. It's a non-chicken soup. It's a no-chicken soup.
I call it vegan chicken soup or a vegan consommé.
Yeah, it was really good.
Okay, let's back up a bit. So I like to do themes.
Yeah.
I get these bugs to create a whole meal on a theme.
And you've been on a roll, too, with soups. I mean, you nailed the French onion soup, which we already talked about, and now you nailed this no chicken consommé.
Yeah, so I was having a craving for Jew food.
Jew food?
Jew food, the kind
you
of food.
You did. You woke up and said, I'm going to make some Jew food. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I've never heard it put that way before, but you're Jewish, or at least you were raised Jewish, so I guess you can say that. You can get away with it.
I guess so. I hope I haven't offended anybody. And if I have, I'm sorry.
Will you forgive Karen?
Yeah, forgive
that
me.
That holiday is coming up.
Yes.
And if you don't, she's going to ask you three times. And if you still don't forgive her, then God will forgive her. Hey,
amen.
How do
Baruch
I do?
Baruch Hashem. Very good, Gary.
Baruch Hashem!
Okay,
continue.
So
I'm just so excited about this menu.
There
can
are
you tell?
Traditional foods that my family would eat during Jewish holidays. Not that we were particularly religious, but like many casual Jews. There were some holidays that were always observed, even if they were observed in a simplistic way. And there was always special foods because, folks, it's all about food.
That's what this program's all about.
It's all about food. There's always chopped liver.
What am I? Vegan chopped liver?
And my mom, decades ago, started making a vegan chopped liver for her three vegan children. And it's really fantastic. So we did a food show for it about a decade ago. I don't know when we did it, but it's up at responsibleeatingandliving.com.
Right. I was on the camera. You were in front of the camera. I was behind the camera.
Exactly. This vegan chopped liver, we also call it a green bean walnut pâté.
Yes, a pâté.
So you don't have to have any religious connotation with it. It's just a lovely spread. And there are some keys to it. Now, people like to do things that are fast. And this is not particularly fast. One of the important pieces of this recipe is caramelizing the onions. And this means you chop the onions, you put them in a pan. Some people put a little oil in the pan. It's not required. You can. And then you cook them slowly. They get translucent and then they get a little brown. And that brown is the caramelizing, and it takes a while for this to happen. If it starts to stick a little bit, you can add a tablespoon or two of water. But you want to slow cook those onions. They become very sweet and very flavorful. And then we add the string beans, and they must be fresh. They can't be frozen.
That's really important. You have to get fresh string beans.
My mother always said they had to be fresh. Once we tried frozen, and it just wasn't the same.
It was fine.
Come on, it wasn't the same.
It was sort of the same.
Okay, what does he know? What does he know?
I mean,
from chopped liver?
You don't open a can of string beans. You get frozen string beans, and they're fresh frozen.
Okay.
Right?
But it's better with fresh.
It wouldn't work if you opened a can of string beans and dumped it in there. No.
And
but
so you add the string beans.
If it's in a pinch, I think people will find that it's still delicious.
Okay. I'll give it to you. But you have to cook the string beans a lot, and you cook them with the onions after the onions have been cooked, and then you throw in some walnuts. And then when it's all nice and cooked.
And the recipe's at Responsible
Eating. It is. Then you put in a food processor and blend it until it looks like a nice pâté.
And there's a video.
Did you mention there was a video?
Yes. Did I mention there was a video?
You add salt. Now, I don't add a lot of salt, but you have to add enough salt.
But you also don't add a lot of oil. That's why it takes you a little longer to caramelize the onions.
Perhaps. No, it takes a long time. Anybody knows. It does not take 5 minutes to caramelize onions. It takes time.
Yes, it does. It does.
But that's the secret to this recipe.
Caramelizing the onions, they get really sweet.
But let's move on from the vegan chopped liver, because the real winner was the consommé.
Well, I think the whole meal was a winner. Rye bread was a winner. The consommé was a winner. The vegan chopped liver was a winner. But yeah, you got to talk about this.
All right.
Now, non-chicken, no chicken soup.
I learned how to do this. And Gary, I know you always say that I like to talk about when I lived in France.
I don't say that derogatorily. I think it's wonderful. I wish I lived in the south of France.
I lived in the south of France for 4 years. And even though I didn't eat the food served in restaurants, I ate vegan food that was served in restaurants, but it wasn't typically what was on the menu. I would always say, can you make me this or that? But I would observe the other foods around me. And one of the popular foods that was always in the supermarkets and often served in restaurants was leeks. And the leeks in France are a little different than the leeks here in the United States. The leeks in France are a little fatter than pencils. They're slim and delicate and lovely. And here in the United States, they're just fat and giant.
Gigantic.
Gigantic. I prefer the slim little ones, but I use the gigantic ones. But leeks are really special, and I recommend getting to know leeks.
Getting to know leek.
Getting to know all about them.
And you know, if something leaks, you better fix it.
Oh, ba-dum-bum. Please. Now, most recipes you see that involve leeks will tell you just to use the white part. And Karen doesn't waste anything.
No, and I think that's the secret.
I chopped up the white and the green.
Yes, you did.
So first you have to make sure you clean the leeks, because there's usually a lot of hidden dirt in between the leaves, which you don't want to crunch on later.
No, sand. There's a lot of sand. You got to wash that sand out.
You have to cut the leek all the way down lengthwise, open it up, and rinse.
You got to wash that sand right out of your leek.
Thank you.
You got to wash that sand right out of your leak. You got to wash that sand right out of your leak. And send it on its way.
Oh. Is that good? We make it up as we go along.
That's good. Send it down the drain.
Send it down the drain.
That's great.
Now, the next part that's important is, just like the onions for the vegan chopped liver, these leeks need to be caramelized.
Oh, yeah.
That means you cook them slowly, gently. I use a big soup pot and I cook them at the bottom. Just keep cooking them. They get softer. They get a little brown. If they start to stick, you add a couple of tablespoons.
Of water.
Right. Thank you.
Not oil.
No. And then I add some chopped carrots and some chopped celery. I cook them till everything's all nice and tender.
Mirepoix.
And that's the mirepoix.
Right.
And mirepoix is really leeks, carrots, and celery.
Sure.
Although other people will use onions, carrots, and celery. But leeks have a special flavor. They're sweeter. It's extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. All vegan chicken soup.
So then I added water. I have a mix of spices, which are simple: onion powder, garlic powder, turmeric. I added parsley and dill.
So here you go. Dill, for me, is what gives it that Jewish chicken soup flavor because
dill is very popular.
And dry red lentils.
Oh, yeah. I'll get to that in a minute. Thank you for reminding me.
Right.
But the dill is a popular spice in Eastern Europe. The Ashkenazi Jews, which came from Eastern Europe, a lot of their recipes reflect the culture that was there. And so dill is an important herb in the Jewish chicken soup, in my opinion. All this stuff goes into the soup and you cook it for a long time. I mean, you could cook it for 30, 40 minutes. The longer, the better. And then you strain it.
Yeah, you have to sieve it.
You have to put it through a sieve. And then you have this broth. And when you taste it, you're going to be blown away.
It's beautiful.
It has no salt and it's all flavor.
Right. And of course, you can salt it if you want, or pepper it, or whatever Karen hasn't done. But I don't recommend that, because it's perfect the way it is.
Yeah. And then you could add to it what you want. I added some thin cappellini noodles. And I've got the cooked vegetables that I've saved.
The stuff that you sieved out of it.
The stuff that I sieved out. And I don't like wasting anything. So my mind's been going on what I'm going to do with them. Stay tuned. I'll tell you next week what happened to those vegetables.
What happened to those little vegetables? We know you're all just going to be at the edge of your seats.
Edge of your seat.
You were commenting tonight as we were eating some of the leftover vegan chopped liver that it was kind of a moussey or lighter than your mom's. It wasn't as heavy.
Now, I don't know why that is unless I used less oil.
Right. It's very good. It was very good.
But it was very fresh and light.
Yeah. I think people would be blown away.
Now, the last thing I made for this light little Jew food meal was you need to have something to smear your vegan chopped liver on.
Right.
And I made a gluten-free
Jewish rye bread.
Rye-style bread. Now, rye is a gluten grain. So rye bread has gluten. And if you're avoiding gluten, I made this whole grain bread that has caraway seeds in it. And the caraway seeds give you the feeling of rye bread because very often rye breads are made with caraway seeds.
Oh, it tasted just like rye bread. It was terrific.
And Thank you, Gary.
It didn't taste like a gluten-free bread. It tasted like a deli rye. It was excellent. It's
an excellent recipe,
and you put it up on the website, correct?
Yes, it's there. It is the caraway seed whole grain bread.
Yep, caraway seed whole grain bread.
So it's funny because that bread recipe started when I interviewed
Marco Borges.
Marco Borges, yes, who was the chef for Ellen DeGeneres. I don't know if he still is, but he's put out a bunch of books.
He put out the 22-Day Revolution Cookbook.
So when I was about to interview him, I made the first recipe in the book, and it was a whole grain gluten-free bread. And of course, I didn't have all the ingredients, so already I'm modifying the recipe, but I made it, and it was really good. And I've made that recipe many times, and I'm always modifying. So the recipe we have at the responsibilityandliving.com website is a brand new recipe because I've made so many changes to it.
You updated it.
Over the years.
Yeah, Marco Borges has written a bunch of cookbooks, and one of them is called Green Print, which is a plant-based diet, best body, better world kind of cookbook. Marco Borges, check him out.
Okay.
And it's a great recipe, and I'm telling you, that, with a little bit of this vegan chopped liver and a big bowl of that chicken soup with the cappellini. The cappellini was a nice touch, but you were also telling me that you could just plop a giant matzo ball in there. And you've got a great matzo ball recipe, too, for people who don't want to eat gluten.
Yeah, so matzo balls are typically made of wheat. They're made from matzah. And Nava Atlas, who I will have back on the program, I hope, shortly. She generates cookbooks.
Really quickly,
and she's got another one out, and she's got another book coming out in December, so she'll be back on the program soon. But she has a lovely matzo ball made not from matzo, not from wheat, but with quinoa flakes.
Right.
But I have some ideas to make a matzo ball
of my own. These are called quinoa balls on our website.
Oh, okay.
Quinoa balls. That's how you'll find them. You can go to our website and put in the search bar matzo, M-A-T-Z-O, ball soup, vegan, gluten-free, and you could find the recipe there for these quinoa balls.
Right. Now, this is traditionally used for the Passover holiday, which doesn't come until next year, and that's March, April timeframe.
But you know, when you go to a deli here in New York City, we have quite a few Jewish delis in New York City, or at least we had. You can get matzo ball soup
any time of the year.
Year round. You could also get chopped liver, and it's served with matzah because that's what they do. In our world, we've got our own little Jewish deli right here, and we're going to serve that soup year round now.
Yeah, I just made a commitment because I forgot how good it was.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's the Jewish vegan penicillin, as they say, about our vegan chicken soup.
You might want to check out the Responsible Eating and Living Facebook page, where I have posted a video from the group Vegan Friendly, which is an Israeli group. And they did a public service announcement, a video commercial which is really powerful. And it has the English translation, even though the people in the film are speaking Hebrew, the English translation is right there. You don't even need the words because the images are pretty powerful. I invite you to check that out.
And we just sent out a newsletter too. I hope all of you got our newsletter. If not, send us your information at info@realmeals.org and we will send you our latest newsletter.
We can subscribe you.
You know, T. Colin Campbell, that guy's no slouch. Right?
Huh? Right.
I mean, he has a PhD daughter, but...
And he's got a son who's a doctor.
A doctor.
Dr. Thomas Campbell.
Have you all read the China study? He was talking about these things way back when.
He was. The China Study is an amazing book, and if you haven't read it, you must, because it reads like a thriller. And it's amazing what T. Colin Campbell has been through over the decades when it comes to food. He sat on government panels making recommendations, and everybody tuned him out because he knew what was going on. There were lobbyists, there was big sugar and big beef and big pork, and they didn't want the information coming out that he knew was truth, that plant foods are what make humans healthy, and animal foods and highly processed foods, white flour foods, sugar foods are not.
Right. This came out, this was published in 2005, and it basically, the China study examines the link between the consumption of animal products, including dairy, and chronic illnesses such as coronary heart disease, diabetes, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and bowel cancer. The authors conclude that people who eat a predominantly whole food vegan diet, avoiding animal products as a main source of nutrition, including beef, pork, poultry, fish, eggs, cheese, and milk, and reducing their intake of processed foods and refined carbohydrates, will escape, reduce, or reverse the development of numerous diseases.
Gary, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I wanted to mention that what I'm reading right now is a new book by Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams. I've had him on the program before, and I will have him on next week. I'm in love with his new book, and it's called...
Oh, come on, let's face it, you're in love with Eric as well.
Well, I guess I am.
Yes, you are.
He's right man for the moment.
He is a wonderful guy,
and he looks great in a suit.
Yeah. That's a great, and it's a fascinating book. You've been telling me about it. I can't wait to read it.
Yes, it's called Healthy at Last. It's coming out in October. I'll be talking with Eric next week, so I hope you join me for that.
And I'll be here to wrap it up.
You absolutely will. I'm looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to that, too. But until then, have a delicious week.